Isaiah chapters 22 and 23, the 16th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on November 11, 2012 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Isaiah chapters 22 and 23. My plan is to slog through these last two chapters of this section. The section goes from 13 to 23. And then next week, I'm going to sum things up as best I can, this whole section. See if I can't bring some coherence to this whole set of oracles. There are 10 oracles in this section. We've looked at 8 of them. Up to now, all of the oracles have had to do with neighbors and or enemies of Judah, and all of them have talked about some kind of impending destruction that's coming their way. This next one is a little different in that it has to do with Jerusalem itself. Chapter 22, I'll read the first 11 verses. The oracle concerning the valley of vision. What is the matter with you now that you have all gone up to the housetops? You who were full of noise, you boisterous town, you exultant city. Your slain were not slain with the sword, nor did they die in battle. All your rulers have fled together and have been captured without the bow. All of you who were found were taken captive alive, though they had fled far away. Therefore, I say, turn your eyes away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. For the Lord God of hosts has a day of panic, subjugation, and confusion in the valley of vision, a breaking down of walls and a crying to the mountain. And Elam took up the quiver with the chariots, infantry, and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. Then your choicest valleys were full of chariots, and the horsemen took up fixed positions at the gate, and he removed the defense of Judah. In that day you depended on the weapons of the house of the forest, and you saw that the breaches in the wall of the city of David were many, and you collected the waters of the pool of the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem, and you tore down houses to fortify the wall. And you made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool. But you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. This oracle is addressed to the, it says it's concerning the valley of vision. In most cases, these oracles have been concerning some geographic name, a place name. Here it's not a place name, but rather a description. We've seen that one other time, possibly two other times. In at the beginning of chapter 21, it was an oracle concerning the wilderness of the sea. Again, that's descriptive rather than a proper name. And then it's possible that the beginning of the oracle in verse 11 of that same chapter, depending on what the reading in the original was, that could also be descriptive rather than a proper name. In any case, this one is a description rather than a proper name, but it has to be with respect to Jerusalem. All of the description that goes on seems to point to Jerusalem. So why does he use the term the Valley of Vision? The word for vision is is in Hebrew is Hitzion, which has Zion in it as a part. So my suspicion is that this is a play on words. That Valley of Vision is the valley of a vision, but the word vision summons up the idea of Zion itself. And later we'll talk about the significance of vision in this oracle. Valley, why valley? Because it's Mount Zion. Why valley? And all I can figure is that from a mount, vision is far. From a valley, vision is limited. And I think what we're going to find here is an oracle in which the vision is limited. The vision is a problem. Their lack of vision is a problem. So I suspect that this is kind of a play on words here to emphasize Jerusalem's lack of vision rather than being a place of vision, which it ought to be. The content of the oracle then starts out with, what's the matter with you that you have all gone up to the housetops? You who are full of noise, a boisterous town, an exultant city. So presumably what's happening here is the people of Jerusalem have gone up to their housetops and there is rejoicing that is taking place. And Isaiah is asking the question, why? Why is there rejoicing taking place? It goes on to describe a situation in which apparently Jerusalem has survived some kind of ordeal, probably an attack. It says, your slain were not slain with the sword, nor did they die in battle. So there isn't talking about a battle. We are talking about people dead. We aren't talking about a battle. It also says, all your rulers have fled together and have been captured without the bow. So the rulers have left Jerusalem. They've fled. They've all been captured, and they were unarmed, though they had fled far away. So presumably the situation is one in which Jerusalem has had some kind of military attack or a siege, and presumably they have survived, and therefore people are rejoicing. Isaiah's response to this is very different. His response is, turn your eyes away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to comfort me concerning the destruction of the daughter of my people. So he's saying, leave me alone. Let me mourn what has happened. What has happened is not good. It is lamentable. And let me mourn. And the thing that has happened is the destruction of the daughter of my people. And I don't know what to make of the daughter of my people, except that it would refer to Jerusalem itself, that the daughter would be Jerusalem itself. He goes on to say then that there is a day of panic, and my translation says subjugation, but other translations have trampling and confusion. So there's the Lord of hosts has this day in which that's characterized by these features. Now, whether this is what had just happened or whether this is yet to come is very difficult to sort out. The verb tenses in these oracles are very difficult to work with because there are times when the past tense is used about things that are clearly in the future, and there are times when the present is used for both future and the present, and so it's really difficult to sort out the chronology. I am inclined to think that what Isaiah is bemoaning is a destruction that is to come. That is, the Lord of hosts has a day of panic, trampling and confusion yet to come to the Valley of Vision. And when that happens, there will be a breaking down of walls and a crying to the mountain. And presumably the mountain that they will be crying to is the Temple Mount, Mount Zion. That they're appealing to the mountain, appealing to the temple. This day of panic, trampling, and confusion is described further here with Elam taking up the quiver with the chariots, infantry, and horsemen, and Kir uncovered the shield. Both Elam and Kir are places within the Babylonian realm. The Persian realm. These would be people allied with the Medes and the Persians. This gets tricky because, we'll get to it later. How do you sort this out? Apparently there is an invasion. And the invasion consists of these soldiers from Elam and Kir. They're coming into the choicest valleys, filling those valleys up with chariots. So this is a big invasion. And horsemen take up fixed positions at the gate. So they're making their way all the way to Jerusalem itself. How does this happen? It's made possible because he, God, has removed the defense of Judah. It's God who has made this possible. God has brought it about. And when this invasion happens, the people of Jerusalem are dependent upon the weapons of the house of the forest. And the house of the forest is a term that refers to a storage area in the temple where weapons were stored. So they are running to the temple and collecting the weapons that are there and using those weapons to defend themselves. And they had made provision for this invasion. They were ready for it. They had done much to prepare for it so that they could withstand the onslaught and the siege. The wall of the city of David were repaired, the breaches in those walls, and the city of David is one section of Jerusalem in the southeastern corner of the city, and historically the center of the city. And you collected the waters of the lower pool. Then you counted the houses of Jerusalem, and you tore down houses to fortify the wall. We know historically that this happened in Jerusalem during the time of Hezekiah, when he was preparing for an invasion from the Assyrians. And there are sections of the wall that have been found that date back to the time of Hezekiah. And they took houses that were in the way or houses that weren't being used, and they dismantled those and used the stones to fill in the holes in the wall, to improve the wall so that they could withstand a siege. You collected the waters of the lower pool. I'm not sure which the lower pool is referring to, but we know that Hezekiah extended the tunnel, the water tunnel, from the source, the Gihon Spring, and took the water down to the pool of Siloam. Presumably all of that then was within the walled city, and so that was a way to spread the water out and collect a lot of that water so that they could withstand a siege for a longer period of time. Just as a point of curiosity, just recently they found a large basin under the Temple Mount, just off to the side, but under the Temple Mount, that was designed to collect any rainwater that landed in that area into a very large basin that would provide water, a cistern that would provide water for the activities in the Temple Mount. And that doesn't date back just to Hezekiah. That goes back further than Hezekiah. But they had large cisterns that they were dependent on for water, especially in a time of siege. It goes on to say that you made a reservoir between the two walls for the waters of the old pool. So this apparently is another cistern that is used to collect water that they can use to withstand a siege. But you did not depend on him who made it, nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. It's not clear what the "it" is in either of these sentences, but I think that it is, I think it is Jerusalem as a whole. You did not depend on him who made it, that is, you who provided for and built up Jerusalem and its defenses, that is, God. Nor did you take into consideration him who planned it long ago. So presumably what's happening here is that Jerusalem has succeeded in withstanding a siege, and the people are rejoicing because they have succeeded. Isaiah, on the other hand, is mourning the fact that there has not been a more sober reflection on what happened. This was not something that was brought about by the cleverness and the planning of the people of Jerusalem, that their success was dependent on the one who founded Jerusalem from the beginning, who established Jerusalem from the beginning, and who has cared for it and provided for it throughout the decades and centuries. He's the one who planned this whole event long ago. And presumably what's lacking is a recognition of God's role in this. The next section. Therefore, in that day, the Lord God of hosts called you to weeping, to wailing, to shaving the head, and to wearing sackcloth. Instead, there is gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. What God has called for is mourning. That is, and I think it's mourning of their own godlessness, their own ingratitude towards God that they've had in the past. And instead of that kind of mourning of their ingratitude, there is celebration. There's gaiety and gladness, killing of cattle and slaughtering of sheep. And the attitude is, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we may die. We'll make the best of it right now. But the Lord of hosts reveals to Isaiah, that this iniquity, and I assume that this iniquity is the ingratitude. Ingratitude is a thread that's gone through all the way through Isaiah from the very beginning. It shall not be forgiven you until you die, says the Lord God of hosts. So there is more discipline that is yet called for as a result of their response. Okay. Trying to sort out this section is difficult in the first place, and then trying to map it on to historical events is also difficult. I consulted four different commentaries, and they all map it on to a different set of historical events. And the problem is, none of them, there is no historical event that we know of that this maps on to neatly. One theory is that this is with respect to an invasion of and a besieging of Jerusalem in 722 BC after by the Assyrians, after the Assyrians had conquered the northern kingdom, Israel. And that all of this is describing that event. That is, that after the Assyrians went away, unsuccessful in their attempt to bring down Jerusalem, that's when the exaltation took place, and it was in preparation for that that all those things were done. The walls were improved and the reservoirs were built, etc. There are two problems with that. The first is we have absolutely no evidence that such an invasion occurred. And had such an invasion occurred, it is unlikely that Elam and Kir, soldiers from Elam and Kir, would have been involved in that. Assyria was at war with the people in the mountains of Iran at that time. It's unlikely that there would have been soldiers from there in their army. The next theory is that this happened in 701. In 701, we know, and there's an account of it here in Isaiah, there's also an account of it in Chronicles, and we also have extra-biblical data with respect to this. The Assyrians attack Jerusalem and besiege it in 701. For several months, they besiege the city, but then they leave suddenly during the night with many dead bodies in their camp. So it's possible that this is with respect to that event, and that they're rejoicing that the Assyrians are gone, it's all over, and they have been victorious. The biggest problem with that is, again, soldiers from Elam and Kir would be unlikely to have been in that army. That the measures that were taken to defend Jerusalem, to prepare Jerusalem, didn't happen until after that invasion. Now I'm having second thoughts about that. I'm not sure that's right. Then the third one is that this is describing the Babylonians coming. And when the Babylonians come, it is possible that there were troops from Elam and Kir that were in that army. And so that's a possibility. Okay, now it comes back to me. No, these provisions were made before the second invasion of the Assyrians. And so that fits better that period. So those are the three main theories. Then Edward Young goes on he points out that none of these fit very well. And so he suggests that what is being described here in kind of symbolic terms is a kind of generic attack on Jerusalem and on the people of God. And that it's he kind of makes it more figurative. It's the forces of the world and mastery of the world, Babylon in his terms, that is attacking Jerusalem. So it's difficult to map this on. We'll talk about this more next time, because this is a problem that occurs in almost every oracle. How do you figure out what this maps onto in history? When is it fulfilled? That's a huge challenge. The second half of the chapter, I think, then, has to be an individual case of the same problem that we've seen in verses 1 through 14. Let me read the first half, 15 through 19. Thus says the Lord God of hosts, come, go to this steward, to Shebna, who is in charge of the royal household. What right do you have here? And whom do you have here, that you have hewn a tomb for yourself here? You who hew a tomb on the height, you who carve a resting place for yourself in the rock, behold, the Lord is about to hurl you headlong, O man, and he is about to grasp you firmly and roll you tightly like a ball, to be cast into a vast country. There you will die, and there your splendid chariots will be, you shame of your master's house. And I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station." So this is said with respect to a single individual, Shebna, who is described as a steward and as one who is in charge of the royal household. Apparently, those are two titles of offices. And in charge of the royal household is a term that was used in Egyptian society to describe the number two person in the land under the pharaoh. Joseph had that designation. So it's thought that Shebna is probably the number two man in Judah, second only to the king. Shebna, by the way, they think is a name of Egyptian origin. So he may not have been an Israelite. He may not have been from the house of Judah. With respect to this person, what Isaiah says is, what are you doing? You're building a tomb. It's a tomb that's very impressive. It's hewn out of stone on the height. He's carving a resting place for himself in the rock. And that's the charge against him. As a result, because of this, God is ready to hurl him headlong. He's ready to take him like a tightly wrapped ball and cast him into a vast country where he will die. And there your splendid chariots will be. It's not clear. That could be translated, your splendid chariots will take you, or it could be your splendid chariots will be. It doesn't indicate whether he would have possession of those splendid chariots. It's possible that they would be taken as loot. It's not clear. Then it describes him as the shame of your master's house. I will depose you from your office, and I will pull you down from your station. Okay, the second half then is in contrast to that. Then it will come about in that day that I will summon my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, and I will clothe him with your tunic and tie your sash securely about him. I will entrust him with your authority, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Then I will set the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens, no one will shut. When he shuts, no one will open. And I will drive him like a peg in a firm place, and he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. So in contrast to Shebna, God is going to place another person in those positions. And it describes him as my servant, which is a term that's used a number of times in Isaiah. We'll come across it later in the book, several times. Eliakim is indicated is designated as the son of Hilkiah. Notice that Shebna is not, it doesn't say who his father is, suggesting possibly shame upon him. Eliakim is the son of Hilkiah. He's going to be put in those positions. All of the trappings of the office that Shebna had are going to be removed from him and placed on Eliakim. He will have all of the authority that Shebna had, and he will become a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. Presumably, this is the point of distinction, that Eliakim is going to be a father to his people. In other words, he is going to look after them like family, an attitude that's apparently in contrast to Shebna. And furthermore, Eliakim is going to have the key of the house of David on his shoulder. When he opens the door, no one shuts it, and when he shuts it, no one will open it. Curiously, there's very similar wording that's used in Revelation 3:7. This is in the message to the church in Philadelphia. It says, "He who is holy, who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, who shuts and no one opens, says this," and it goes on. And this Eliakim is going to be driven like a pig in a firm place. He's going to be one that can be relied upon, depended upon. He's going to be firm and steadfast. And he will become a throne of glory to his father's house. Presumably, the throne of glory is the sense of the king can sit here and rely upon him. So it's apparently another metaphor of his reliability. The last two verses are very strange. They read, "So they will hang on him all the glory of his father's house, offspring and issue, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. In that day, declares the Lord of hosts, the peg driven in a firm place will give way. It will even break off and fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken." So this firm peg that's reliable and can be depended on, apparently will be depended on by all of the father of his father's house, all the offspring and issue. It says, all the least of vessels, from bowls to all the jars. So it's absolutely everyone in his father's household dependent on him, even those who have no significance of their own, individual significance. So they are all dependent on him. Interestingly, the rabbinic literature thinks that what's happening here is nepotism, that he is using relatives in various positions in the administration, showing favoritism to his own family. But in that day, the peg driven in a firm place will give way. It will even break off and fall. So even this Eliakim in that day, who was commended for his reliability, gives way in that day. And the load hanging on it will be cut off, for the Lord has spoken, is the only reason given for that. Like I say, I really don't know what to make of that. That's a strange turn at the end of the chapter. Okay, next one is an oracle with respect to Tyre. Let me tell you just a little bit about Tyre. Tyre was a city, a very significant city, just north of Israel and in modern-day Lebanon. In fact, it's only a 12 miles, I think, north of the border between Israel and Lebanon today. Tyre was one of the two main cities in that area. Tyre and Sidon were the two main ones. That area is culturally Canaanite. There were people living there in the time when Abraham came into the land, into the promised land. There were Canaanites living north of the promised land in the area of Tyre and of Sidon. And they had been there, they remained in that area throughout the history of the Old Testament period. During the time of David, Tyre was friendly with respect to David, and the materials that were used to build the first temple were sent by King Hiram of Tyre to Jerusalem for that construction. So they were on very friendly terms. But there are indications that later on, Tyre began to be a rival of Israel and Judah, and there were tensions between the two groups. Now, from about the time of David on, historically speaking, the term that's used to describe the culture of Tyre and Sidon is the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians were a culture, and I stress culture as opposed to a kingdom, because it was composed of city-states, and the city-states fought among themselves. So they were not united, but they were a culture, one culture. Same language, same religion, many other cultural features were shared. And the Phoenicians were very innovative. The first alphabet comes from the Phoenicians. That is, alphabet where a letter represents a single sound. A symbol represents a single sound. That originated with the Phoenicians. There were a number of other things that they did that were innovative. But their most significant feature was that they were very comfortable on the seas. They became a sea-going culture. And I remember one of my teachers in graduate school pointed out that the Greeks were in their ships all the time, but they were never comfortable on the sea. And one of the ways you can see that is they would always put in at night. They would always beach their ships at night. They wouldn't spend the night on the sea. And then in the morning, they'd push them back out and sail off. But they would always stay within eyesight of land, if at all possible. The Phoenicians, on the other hand, were quite comfortable on the sea, became very good at navigating. They went all over the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean, as I understand it, is a relatively easy place to learn to sail in. Historians say that there are three places in the world that were historically easy to sail in and as a result developed sea-going cultures. One is the South Pacific, the other is the Baltic Sea, and the third is the Mediterranean. And all of those areas developed sea-going cultures as a result of that. And once they became very good at plying the seas where it was sheltered, then they made their way out into the oceans. And we know that the Phoenicians did that. They were some of the first people to go out into the Atlantic. And then there's some evidence that they went up the west coast of Europe, and there are some who have speculated they even made it, some Phoenicians made it to the Americas way back when, but I don't know if that's true or not. We do know that they were all over the Mediterranean, and they were some of the first ones to begin to explore and to develop trade ties with the western half of the Mediterranean. In particular, they were interested in Spain. Spain was interesting for two reasons. One is it had a wealth of metal ores that could be mined. And the second is the people who lived in Spain had developed the technology to make very fine metals. And as a result, the Phoenicians were interested in developing ties there that where they could exploit those things. So we know that they established colonies in Spain, but they also established colonies in North Africa, the most famous of which is Carthage, which became a much bigger city and more important city than its mother city, Sidon, which founded it. So Tyre and Sidon were both very active throughout the Mediterranean, developing these colonies and trade ties, and they became the merchant navy of the world at the time. Their ships would carry grain from the Nile to Greece or from the Baltic, from the Black Sea to Greece and points west. They were going all over the Mediterranean Sea. And as a result, they were becoming very wealthy. Tyre became a very wealthy city as a result of all this trade. Trade is a risky business, but if you can pull it off, you can make a lot of money. That's historically true, and that was certainly true of Tyre. Tyre, interestingly, was a city that consisted of two parts. One part was on the mainland, and the other part was on an island that was a half a mile away out into the sea. Sometimes they are both referred to as Tyre. Sometimes they are referred to by different names. And we know historically that there were times when the two halves of the city were at war. But for most of their history, they were dependent one on the other and were cooperative. Okay, with that background then, let's look at the first seven verses of this chapter. The oracle concerning Tyre. Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed without house or harbor. It is reported to them from the land of Cyprus. Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon. Your messengers crossed the sea and were on many waters. The grain of the Nile, the harvest of the river, was her revenue, and she was the market of nations. Be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea, saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish at the report of Tyre. Pass over to Tarshish. Wail, O inhabitants of the coastland. Is this your jubilant city, whose origin is from antiquity, whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places? Okay, with respect to Tyre, the ships of Tarshish are supposed to wail. Tarshish is, to historians' best ability to identify it, they think is in Spain. So this is apparently one of the colonies established by the Phoenicians in Spain. And it says, wail, O ships of Tarshish, for Tyre is destroyed without house or harbor. So Tyre's been destroyed, the harbor's not usable, there's no house there left. And a report of this destruction reaches these ships from the land of Cyprus. Cyprus was an island, still is, an island in the Mediterranean that was used as a stopping point when ships were going either east or west across the Mediterranean. So apparently news of the destruction of Tyre has reached Cyprus, and the ships learn of it when they put in at Cyprus. Be silent, you inhabitants of the coastland, you merchants of Sidon. The inhabitants of the coastland seems to indicate the people along the Levant, so the people along the coastline of Lebanon and into Israel. They are to be silent, and I think the silence is from being sobered because the unthinkable has happened. Even Tyre has fallen. I should point out, the inhabitants of Tyre thought that their island, the island part, was impregnable. They thought that it could not be. It was extremely highly fortified. It was on an island, and it had big city walls surrounding it. And they thought that it was impregnable and took great pride in that. So be sobered, you inhabitants along the coastland. This could happen to any of you. Your messengers crossed the sea and were on many waters. In other words, the peoples from Tyre had been spread out throughout the Mediterranean. The grain of the Nile was harvested and carried in their ships. She was the market of the nations. So she's the merchant navy of the world, Tyre. It goes on to say, be ashamed, O Sidon, for the sea speaks, the stronghold of the sea speaks. And I think that's with respect to Tyre. Tyre is saying, I have neither travailed nor given birth. I have neither brought up young men nor reared virgins. I think what's being said here is, I have done nothing that secures my destiny, my future. I have accomplished nothing that will stand the test of time. nothing that will outlive me. That's what Tyre is saying. When the report reaches Egypt, they will be in anguish over the report. And then pass over to Tarshish, whale inhabitants of the coastland. Is this your jubilant city whose origin is from antiquity? Tyre, the founding of Tyre, according to the legends within Phoenician culture, go back to 2700, so a very old city, and whose feet used to carry her to colonize distant places. So this economic powerhouse, Tyre, has gone down, and that should sober everyone throughout the Mediterranean area. Verses 8 through 12. Who has planned this against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth? The Lord of hosts has planned it to defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. Overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint. He has stretched his hand out over the sea. He has made the kingdoms tremble. The Lord has given a command concerning Canaan to demolish its strongholds. And he has said, you shall exult no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon. Arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest. So the question is, who's brought this about? Who planned this? Especially with respect to Tyre, who is the bestower of crowns. So Tyre has a reputation for being a kingmaker. They're the ones whose influence, and presumably that's influence through economic forces and money, controls or has a big say in who rules in the lands of the area, and whose merchants were princes, whose traders were the honored of the earth. Their merchants and their princes are so wealthy that they are honored all over the earth. So who's planned this against Tyre, who is so powerful? The answer, verse 9, is the Lord of hosts. Why did he do it? To defile the pride of all beauty, to despise all the honored of the earth. And we've seen that theme several times before in Isaiah, that he's going to bring down the arrogant. He's going to bring down the proud. And here we have the proudest of nations being brought down, the proudest of cities. Verse 10 is difficult. My translation says, overflow your land like the Nile, O daughter of Tarshish. There is no more restraint. Some commentators go with this wording, and if this is the case, then what it's saying is, it's assuming that Tarshish was a colony of Tyre, but was being oppressed by Tyre. In one way or another, is under Tyre's thumb. And now that Tyre's gone, it can rejoice. There is no more restraint. I think that unlikely, because twice in this chapter, it says that Tarshish is to wail. So this is not a time of rejoicing over liberation, but rather this is a time of sober reflection. How could this have happened? So another way to take this verse is, instead of overflow your land, it can mean to pass over, and it could be pass over in the sense of work your land, farm your land. And then it goes, and then when it says there is no more restraint, instead of restraint, that could be harbor. In other words, turn to farming. Your life as merchants is over, you of Tarshish. I think that more likely. In any case, God has stretched his hand out over the sea. He's the one who has made this happen. He's the one who makes kingdoms tremble. And he's the one who has decided that it is time for the strongholds in Canaan to be destroyed. So the destruction of Tyre was all well a part of God's plan from the beginning. But now Isaiah turns to Sidon and says, "You shall exult no more, O crushed virgin daughter of Sidon." When I read this verse, I couldn't help but think about sporting events yesterday. That Oregon's football team, as you know, has been ranked third in the BCS. Alabama has been ranked first. Alabama played yesterday early in the day, and Alabama lost. So how do the Ducks respond to that? Well, one response is to rejoice, because the number one team is gone. That means that Oregon moves up. But I think there's another response that probably occurred to everyone, and that is, if Alabama lost, what could happen to us? And there's got to be some of that feeling that if everything goes the way it's supposed to, the ones who are expected to be strong remain strong, then it's like you may not like them, but at least the world's the way it's supposed to be. But what gets tricky is when those who aren't supposed to lose, lose. Now what kind of world is this? And how do we think about it? And I think here Isaiah's advice to Sidon is to not exult, because they could experience the same fate. It says, "Arise, pass over to Cyprus. Even there you will find no rest." There is no place of security, ultimately. Okay, the last section. "Behold the land of the Chaldeans. This is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures. They erected their siege towers. They stripped its palaces. They made it a ruin. Wail, O ships of Tarshish, for your stronghold is destroyed. Now it will come about in that day that Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years, like the days of one king. At the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. Take your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. And it will come about at the end of 70 years that the Lord will visit Tyre. Then she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. And her gain and her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord. It will not be stored up or hoarded, but her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord." Now, this too gets weird at the end of the chapter, but the first couple of verses make some sense. It says, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans." So that is Babylon. It says, "This is the people which was not. Assyria appointed it for desert creatures." So Assyria wanted to make a wasteland of Babylon. And this is before Babylon resurrected itself. Assyria set out to just lay waste to that land. And it was not a people. And yet, it formed into a people, and it became a powerful people. And it grew in this desert wasteland that Assyria had made it into. And it's they who came, and they erected their siege towers, they stripped its palaces, they made it a ruin. I think that is with respect to Tyre. They're the ones who did it. And isn't that interesting that they came from nowhere and became this world power? And the implications are, God's been working on this for a long time. This is not a recent development. God was doing this, starting this long ago, and brought about all the steps along the way to make this happen. That's why the ships of Tarshish should wail, for their stronghold is destroyed. I will point out that the Babylonians did come and lay waste the Tyre that was on the mainland. It's not clear. There is some indication that they also received tribute from the Tyre on the island, but they did not conquer it, and they were not able to lay it waste. That happened later, a couple hundred years later, when Alexander the Great came through, and according to the stories, he went to the coastline just across from Tyre, the island, and the people of Tyre taunted him and said he couldn't get them. And so he, in keeping with the prophecy in Ezekiel, he took rubble from the houses that were laid waste by the Babylonians of mainland Tyre, put them in the water, and built a ramp across the water. It's a half a mile separation. He built a ramp all the way to the walled city, and then he was able to take it. Don't taunt Alexander the Great. Now, this last section is really tough. For 70 years like the days of one king, it's not clear what that means. The days of one king, that phrase you would expect to mean the time during which a king reigned. So the total reign of a king. Tyre will be forgotten for 70 years like the days of one king. I don't know what the like means here. Most commentators take this to mean that it's 70 years, which is approximately the length of reign of a king with a long reign. Well, 70 years is a very long reign at that time. But why that expression? I do not know. At the end of the 7 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot. And we've got this song. It says, take up your harp, walk about the city, O forgotten harlot. Pluck the strings skillfully, sing many songs that you may be remembered. So Tyre is likened to a harlot. And I suspect that the reason that that is an apt way of characterizing Tyre is because Tyre made a profession of satisfying the sensual desires of people throughout the Mediterranean. That's how they made their money. It's selling luxury items primarily, cloth, spices, oils, etc. And so that kind of trade, I think, is being likened to harlotry. And so it is going to happen to Tyre, as in this song. It's take up your musical instrument and go around the city. You've been forgotten, but you can still play the harp, and people will remember you. Remember who you were, and apparently your fame will be recalled. In any case, at the end of those 70 years, it says the Lord will visit Tyre, and she will go back to her harlot's wages and will play the harlot with all the kingdoms on the face of the earth. So it sounds like going back to the same kind of trade activity that she had been involved in earlier. And then the gain from her harlot's wages will be set apart to the Lord, and it will become sufficient. Her gain will become sufficient food and choice attire for those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. So the profits that she has received will go towards supporting those who dwell in the presence of the Lord. And I don't know what that means. Okay, very, very quickly, I didn't talk about chapter 22 and the two halves. What do the two halves have to do with each other? In the first half, it's people who are proud of the fact that by their efforts and clever preparations, they have been able to withstand an assault on their city. And Isaiah's response is, you should be mourning. You should recognize the discipline that's been administered to you and repent and turn from your ways. Recognize that your salvation came from God, not by your efforts. In the second half, it's talking about a royal official who's preoccupied building an impressive tomb for himself, apparently at the expense of the well-being of his people. That is, he's building something to be remembered by, a legacy. And he's criticized for that, castigated for that. I think that these have to be related, and the only way I can relate them is in both cases, it's a kind of arrogance. In both cases, it's a lack of recognition of God's role and an overemphasis on the role of their own cleverness and ability, skill, whatever. And in that sense, then, they lack vision. They can't see things for what they are. They can't see God at work and the things that God has done and provided. And as a result, they are worthy of the punishment that will come. Okay, I told you last week I'd leave lots of time for questions. I lied, but there is a little bit of time, so any questions that you have?
The people are rejoicing, but people were slain in battle, and all their leaders were captured.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get why that's.
Well, I think the point is they're rejoicing because they survived. But the reason that those two things are mentioned is because they seem to be thinking, we survived because we are so good. And Isaiah's pointing out, really? It's your efforts that brought this about? I mean, there are people who died right here and nobody killed them. Your rulers ran off unarmed. So it's your prowess that brought this about? That makes no sense.
I see. So they won, but it's obvious that it wasn't because of their preparations.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. But apparently the exulting is in the attitude behind it is we did it.
Cool.
And a lack of recognition that God was the one who was actually making that possible.
I have a lot of holes in my biblical education. I was wondering if you could fill in the Philistines and the Phoenicians. Are they related in any way? I'm under the impression that the Philistines were started as colonies by seagoing peoples.
Right. Right. The Philistines, the Phoenicians were there first, but they're called Canaanites. At that time in history, they would be called Canaanites. So the Canaanites were there. They were in along the coast of Israel as well as along the coast of Lebanon, present-day Lebanon. In about 1200, there were seagoing peoples that are Greek, essentially Greek, and they spread out all over the eastern Mediterranean, kind of like the Vikings did in the Middle Ages. They were just going on raiding parties. But as the Vikings, they realized that commuting was a drag. So, and it was better to just go to the place that you were going to plunder and pillage and stay and plunder and pillage on a regular basis. So that's essentially what the Philistines ended up. Those are Greeks that came to the coast of Israel. They took over that coastal region from the Canaanites, became overlords of the Canaanites, mixed with the population there, but they were in control governmentally, politically. And as typically happens in that kind of situation, the culture becomes the culture of the people that are there. Typically, mothers carry culture. And so these Greeks intermarried with the Canaanites, but the culture was overwhelmingly Canaanite. So the Philistines have a culture that is very Canaanite-like for the most part. Up north, those are Canaanites going way back. There's no Greek influence there, no Greek invasion. I shouldn't say no Greek influence because there is Greek influence, but that's through trade ties, not through invasion. So to the north, the Phoenicians, that goes directly back to Canaanite culture. They are essentially Canaanites with no Greek invasion. Does that help?
It does. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay. Next week, what I hope to do, this section is extremely difficult. And part of what I want to do next week is demonstrate how difficult it is. And so I just kind of floundering, trying to make the best sense that I can of it. But there are myriads of unresolved issues. But I think that there is benefit to kind of stepping back and looking at the whole. And I think that some coherence can be brought to it by so doing. So that's primarily what I'm going to try to do next week, and we'll see how successful that is. But thanks.